Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On today's show, we'll be talking about the new, old, and controversial novel by Harper Lee, Go Set a Watchman. John Powers is here to talk about the relentless positivity of the American Movie Review.
And Book Review.
And there's going to be a special guest, one of the stars of The Office and now an author. We're very excited to have BJ Novak on the show.
So finally, the Harper Lee novel, Go Set a Watchman, is going to be published this week. And we talked about it earlier, like months and months earlier when they first announced the book. And I think Seth and I disagreed.
Yeah, what I said to revisit my argument for a moment was that while this manuscript has interest certainly to people who are interested in Harper Lee's career and to scholars, the fact that it's been in a closet for 50 years, clearly she hasn't wanted to publish it. And that would indicate to me that the publication of the book is, in fact, exploitive. And I feel like it should have been held on to until she passed away, in which point it has instant literary historical influence and real value. And I question the moral action of publishing it now.
Oh, for crying out loud, let her have a little moment in the sun. Why not?
You know, people say that she's totally compos mentis, and I just have a hard time buying that.
Okay.
Well, now that it is coming out and everyone's writing about and talking about it, as we will right now, I can't help feeling it's nice to have this flurry of interest in not only the original book. I'm sure it's sending a lot of, you know, young people to the original book or people that didn't read it. But also, it raises interesting questions about how we perceive racism differently in different epochs or different eras. That this first version of To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus, in fact, attends a meeting of the Ku Klux Klan and espouses some very racist views in the book.
To be clear, you're calling Go Set a Watchman the first version of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right, which I think is the case. Her editor, Harper Lee's editor, said, no, let's focus on Scout as a young woman, as a girl, not a young woman. In Go Set a Watchman, Scout is a grown woman living in New York. She goes back to her small town, and she is disheartened by the racism that she sees there because now she's an urbane young woman having lived in New York. Basically, her editor steered her away from that and steered her toward a more of a mythical Atticus, who is the white symbol of justice in an unjust world. And it's a simpler book for perhaps a simpler time. Maybe we needed that hero at that time.
Well, one of the reasons that To Kill a Mockingbird has not been an important book for me personally is that I felt almost as if it was created using an algorithm. In other words, it's a binary world. There is a lack of complexity. And because of this, people can apprehend the book pretty fully by the time they're 12. And the new book, Go Set a Watchman, which I had no interest in reading, the second I learned that Atticus was a racist, I suddenly wanted to read the book because all of a sudden it contains complexity. It contains a wider universe that can accept a less doctrinaire view of things. And it becomes interesting and adult, actually. And to me, it's a way more compelling tale when a young woman goes back, finds out that her beloved father, her role model, in fact, has this hidden racist background and then has to wrestle with that than the hagiography that occurs in To Kill a Mockingbird when the young scout looks at Atticus completely admiringly, which to me is utterly uninteresting.
So well, you're saying you're happy it was published?
You know, on a certain level, I'm happy it was published because of that, because I think it's an interesting thing. Although I do think that the people who are surrounding Harper Lee right now are the equivalent of Colonel Parker pushing Fat Elvis onto the stage.
even if the new slash old book, Go Set a Watchman, is not as complex and interesting as you're making it sound, which we don't know because we've only read the first chapter because that's all that's been made public at this time. But even if it's not as complex and interesting, morally interesting as we hope and think it could be, just the discussion that we're having about the perfect Atticus versus the morally compromised Atticus is an interesting one to have.
Well, the Atticus that from To Kill a Mockingbird is much younger than the Atticus in this book, right? The Atticus in this book is an old crotchety guy who has adopted a lot of conservative, you know, community standard for his time and place, right?
Yeah, it's Atticus who started watching Fox News.
And yeah, he thinks the NAACP is sticking their nose in where they shouldn't, and he thinks that the Supreme Court decisions, Brown versus Board of Education, is destroying states' rights. So he has attitudes and beliefs that were the standard beliefs of the people of his time and place. And in the earlier book, he's a young idealist, and he doesn't buy those attitudes.
Now,
so he's taken a trajectory that we know of from other novels and from other stories and from real life.
But I find it to be a bizarre one, because for the guy to have given the full-throated defense of Tom Robinson, who was the black guy on trial in To Kill a Mockingbird, to have evolved into this cranky old racist, to me is not really a buy. And that's why I cannot just sign off on Harper Lee having full agency in terms of its publication, but no matter what you guys say to me.
He didn't evolve from one to the other, because in fact, it's not a prequel. It's an earlier version of the story. So she changed the story. And in a way, the two versions of the story represent two ways of looking at literature. That is, you know, in one you have inspirational, a modeling of behavior, and in the other you have what is, you know, maybe a much truer picture of what her small town looked like.
You're right. And on a scholarly level, I think that's fascinating. But to a certain degree, the conversation we're having is kind of inside baseball, which is appropriate since this is the LARB radio hour. But I think that a lot of people are going to be very freaked out by this new Atticus 2.0. And I think this is very much not what was intended by the publishers, who I think wanted to see this book enshrined in the canon right next to Kill a Mockingbird. And who knows? You know what? That might happen. But given,
yeah, it's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen.
But given Racist Atticus, I'm with you guys. I think that's pretty unlikely.
But the publisher, aside from, you know, possibly being exploitive and wanting to make money, I mean, they are showing a more complex world than the first book showed. And I think that they should be lauded for that. Also, we talked about the title and how we feel it's an awkward sounding title, and it is, but I just looked it up, and it does come from the King James Bible. The quote is, "For thus hath the Lord said unto me, go set a watchman, let him declare what he seeth." In the context of this book, I think we're to understand that Harper Lee is reporting what she seeth in her small town of Macomb. And if she chose that for her title, she's saying, it's important that I go back to that town and I report on what those attitudes are there.
Now, we three have read the first chapter because that's the only thing that was available to us. Now, given that we are the LA Review of Books, why were we only able to get the first chapter when our friend David Yulin at the Los Angeles Times read it and reviewed it, and Michiko Kakutani reviewed it for the New York Times?
The Washington Post reviewed it.
Washington Post reviewed it. What gives?
I sent an email and asked them why. I was asked why I wanted to know. I said it was for a radio show. We're going to be talking about it on our radio show. I said, what station is the radio show on and when is it going to air? And so we had a little back and forth. And then finally, I got an email that said, upon further thought, we do not make a habit of discussing the mechanics behind our publicity campaigns. They are deciding who's going to be able to talk about it and who's not.
Well, a few days early.
Usually what we know from Hollywood is you don't give a film to critics if you know it's terrible, right? And because you don't want the critics talking about it and ruining your sales, right? So I think the reason they didn't give it to the Los Angeles Review of Books is because they didn't want to ruin their sales potential.
But why would we be harsher than Michi Kakutani?
I don't know what kind of arrangement they made with Michi, or David for that matter. We should ask him.
Well, if you're suggesting that the arrangement could have included a guarantee of a good review, of course, no book review critic would do that. So I just think that we weren't on their A-list.
Isn't this book critic proof?
Yeah.
No.
Well, in terms of its entry into the canon, certainly no. But in terms of its sales, it'll sell over 1 million copies.
Definitely.
I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM.
To Kill a Mockingbird was published in 1960. Given where we were in the evolution of our civil rights, at that point, not at a very advanced stage and about to go into a very violent era, maybe in 1960, what was needed, and maybe Harper Lee's editor felt this, what was needed was an unambiguous book about standing up for right and being a just person and helping make the world a fairer place. And And I would say that is what was needed, because the book was a tremendous success. It won a Pulitzer right away. It sold, was immediately successful commercially. But now perhaps that's not what we need.
Well, it comes from an era when the idea of the hero remained the traditional idea of the hero. Atticus Finch, as he was presented in 1960, today would be ridiculous, because what we've learned in the last 50 or 60 years is that these heroes all have more complexity at their root than what one was allowed to acknowledge back then. Whereas the Atticus we're learning about now, who's going to be launched into the world tomorrow officially, we're taping this right before the publication date, is interestingly, you know, much more appropriate for today because of that complexity.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why we're having the conversation in exactly this way. That is, that why does it make sense to say that because she imagined two different stories with a few overlapping characters, and the stories are completely different, right? They're just not the same story. She imagined one story. Her editor said, you know, I don't like this story. You know, why don't you make the godfather a good grandfather and have some redeeming characteristics instead of just being a killer? You change the novel because of your editor's suggestions. Now what we're getting is a gussied up first draft that was rejected by her publisher. And so the idea that it's different doesn't mean it's better for now or better for then, or it's right. The publishing environment in 1960 was maybe slightly different than it is now, but it's not that different. That is, people are making commercial decisions all of the time. The commercial decision to print this book has nothing to do with the fact that Atticus Finch is a racist. It's got everything to do with the continued sales power of Harper Lee and her name.
That's true. But the fact that her publisher said, no, this is not a commercial story in 1960, and what we need is X in 1960, I think is interesting.
But that's why I go back to it. It has scholarly interest and commercial interest, clearly, because the first book was so popular. But the disconnect between the basic nature of one of the main characters, to me, is really the argument for this to be a sideshow, ultimately.
Well, yeah, but it's also because Atticus Finch is a racist that makes this interesting. Let's say Atticus Finch was just, like, not a very good lawyer, right? He's acquitted in the new version. He's not found guilty, right? If Atticus Finch was just a bad lawyer in the first version, and they said, why not make him a good lawyer, and he has to face against all his prejudices? That would be one kind of decision. Then this book would not be interesting. It's interesting because, like Günter Grass, or like Waldheim, Kurt Waldheim, we find out he's a Nazi, and that's of interest to everybody.
So, Tom, Lori, last question. Are you guys going to read Gossetta Watchmen in its entirety?
No.
Probably not.
I'm undecided.
Once again, we have failed to read the book we discuss.
You know him from Vogue, from Fresh Air on NPR. Critic John Powers is with us today to talk about all things literary and filmic. Welcome, John.
Hello.
So over the weekend, Tom and I went out to see Inside Out. We rarely go out to movies. I think, like most Americans, we watch most things on our huge screen TV, and very few things get us out of the house. Well, it was very hot. So
you don't have to say it's huge.
It's so bougie, Lori.
This is KPFK.
Okay, so we have an 18-inch TV, and we watch most things on that. But anyway, we went out. It was very hot. We wanted air conditioning. Because we're not bougie, we don't have air conditioning. So we went to see it, and one of the reasons I wanted to see it, well, it sounded good. The reviews made it sound really good. Also, Tom has written a lot about emotions and how we process emotions and emotions in historical contexts. And we were disappointed, I think, partly because the reviews oversold it. It was a good idea. It was a merry experience. It was fun. We laughed. But ultimately, we felt like the Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is? John, you said you kind of had a feeling that that might be the case just from having read the reviews.
I did, yeah. Maybe because I feel that way about almost everything I read about these days, is that, especially with things that people like, they tend to push it so far that you can't trust it. And Inside Out was one of those, because everything I knew about it made me think, oh, this might be a very enjoyable animated film. But people were writing about it as if this were some sort of psychological breakthrough and that it was going to be profound. And I thought probably that's not the case, but that it would probably be a very enjoyable and witty version of playing with emotions. But You know, I've seen all the other Pixar films. There are many things, but Profound isn't one of them. You know, they're funny, they're touching, they're well-made. And I couldn't imagine that these people had deepened so much that they would be offering psychological revelation.
Part of the news about it was that there was a neuroscientist on,
oh, of course,
right,
of course,
consultant, all, and all of these.
There's always a neuroscientist with these things. Like, you know, like
we have one in the garage right now.
You know, I'm sure the fish one, you know, they had some oceanographer. You know, I mean, they always have that guy.
I want that job.
Yeah, I know. It's I mean,
can I be an oceanographer for Pixar?
In that great Pixar literary criticism film, they will need a literary editor.
But it's an interesting question, though, about review writing, which I'd like to ask you about. I reviewed theater for 10 years, both in New York and here. You've been a longtime movie reviewer. It is interesting. Sometimes it's hard to find the sweet spot from which you reviewed the film. In other words, sometimes your head gets filled with, I'm just speaking for myself, John, this may not happen to you. You know, you put yourself in the mind of the producer or the writer or the actors who've worked so hard. You can't do that. You know, that's the kiss of death for a reviewer. But sometimes they invade your thoughts because you're an empathetic person. There are concerns that shouldn't crowd your mind when you're reviewing. Do you find that to be a struggle at all?
Oh, I do, but I never think I have any weird identification or sympathy for the artist. Usually I'm putting myself in the mind of an editor at some publication who doesn't want to hear about something that's okay. You know, that the structure of the business is everybody in every line of media feels they're competing for precious space. And the way you get attention in that precious space is having a strong opinion. Modulation doesn't work. You know, so that you have to have this hyper strong opinion, usually expressed—
Good or bad.
Good or bad. Early on, it has to be that. I mean, I've compared it to the way that in movies now, you have to open with a big, exciting action sequence so that you grab people and then you can actually give them the movie. I think you often have to have an overstated introductory paragraph or two where you're selling something as either this is the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, because otherwise, really, the fear is that nobody will be interested in it. Who wants to see that pretty good movie that came out of Sundance? They want it to be so moving and so deep and so steeped in cinephilia. And in fact, that's the current Sundance film out called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which won and got all these rave reviews. And then I went to see it and thought, this is perfectly okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a nice little film. The lead actor's pretty good. The girl's a drip. It's okay, but somehow it was being sold as this important thing, and it's not that.
Mm-hmm. Has criticism evolved to that binary state, or was it different prior?
Well, it used to be different, and it all depended on where you were working. I always remember the way that things like Time magazine would run 1,500-word reviews of foreign films. And like, there's no way really that you can talk about an Antonioni film and make it sound great in the way that people want to make Inside Out sound great. Okay. The other thing that enters in here, if I think this is relevant, is that when you see something that's decent as a critic, you're so terrified that nobody will pay attention that you suddenly become shrill telling people that they really have to see it, because you feel as if in almost every medium, but certainly in film, that things are getting so much dumber and so much worse that anything with any kind of intelligence deserves championing. And once you start doing that, you enter into the realm where you're actually one of the PR people for the film.
Do you know who was good at handling that? I think was Pauline Kael. I think I'm a bigger fan of hers than you are, from,
yes,
if I'm remembering correctly, from past conversations. But she had a way of using superlatives. I believe that she believed what she was saying, but she always had a superlative in her review to sell it. And she did it so well, she would say, like, Blythe Danner's performance in this movie is the most sublime expression of a ice cream seller. Like, it was a very specific.
No, the most sublime expression of quirkiness.
Yeah,
is what,
right,
she would say.
Right, yeah, but she did do that. But one of my first jobs was writing jacket copy at Knopf. That was right. One of my first jobs. And it was easy and refreshing, because at the same time, I was also writing criticism for other papers. But when you wrote jacket copy, you read the book and you combed for what you liked about it, and you forgot what you didn't like about it. And then you wrote this great praise of it. It was fun. It was easy.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is when you write jacket copy for yourself. I mean, I think probably all of us have had a book, and what's startling is that you think there must be these crack professionals who are turning out corruptly complimentary jacket copy.
Would that it were so.
Yes. And in fact, you were getting, even from smart editors, subliterate maundering that they then sent you 2 minutes before it goes out. And they say, can you change this? And then you write essentially the plot description of some sort and the positive review of the book you'd like to get. You yourself write it, and they stick it on the book.
Right.
Yes.
I feel like you just called me a subliterate mongrel. Though.
Things were different then. But the thing that's so interesting was when I was doing that kind of inflating hack work, it came very easily to me, because I've spent so many years having to overpraise things in almost all media that when I was time to overpraise myself, I could slide into it with less self-consciousness than one might think.
So you are part of the problem.
You're part of the problem.
Is there any way to be part of the solution?
Not an earn a living doing it.
I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM.
What about writing pans? Don't people like reading pans?
Less now. I think almost nobody likes pans anymore, unless it's of something, a big safe target. Mm-hmm. They don't want you panning something that doesn't seem big enough to deserve it. But the other thing is, culturally, we live in an age where one of the predominant modes of criticism is to be insanely enthusiastic. This is clearest with television at the moment, where you have the people writing 5,000 words about every episode of Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And they are back.
Guilty.
And the most primitive level, I think, of criticism, where the assumption is that everything that Matthew Weiner put in it belonged to be there and was a brilliant choice. So you're merely, when you analyze anything, you're analyzing why this too was another brilliant choice. Oh, this might have looked corrupt, but in fact, yes, in a sense it's corrupt, but Matthew Weiner's been so difficult to the audience that of course he's going to put Peggy and Stan together at the end because the audience wanted that. And you have to give the audience something which only goes to prove the higher wisdom of Matthew Weiner.
That's true.
I mean, the other part of it is, the dark truth or something that we don't like to talk about is that so much of what the culture machinery talks about as representing the culture is an incredible minority taste defined to flatter the minority taste of people like us. We are now at the place where we are doing the misleading thing of thinking and asking the question often, what does Mad Men say about our culture now? And what it actually says is that there's a certain kind of niche programming for elite people. That's really what it says. But that in fact, it's not the expression of the culture that should reveal where we are now.
Well, yes and no, right? I mean, hasn't it always been true that philosophy tells us something about where we are now, but many fewer than 2 million people read any particular philosophy?
No, that's true. I'm not saying it's meaningless. Yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is the overlarge interpretation, which I've spent most of my career doing, and so there's a lot of mea culpa in this, which is like taking some movie or TV show and then extrapolating some huge cultural meaning out of it, when in fact it's probably closer to a Nabokovian game. Notice how I can link these three things about Mad Men to the Obama era.
Right.
That's probably closer to it. It's not necessarily a revelatory truth, mm-hmm. but it's a cool thing that might make you think. It's not worth doing.
I just want to give a shout out to Pete Wells, because this is a critic. He's the New York Times food critic, and he has found a way to do the big pan, which is pretty much missing from our culture now, in a way that people love and don't get offended by. It's true, he does only do it to big name restaurants. But I'll just give you a little tiny taste of his review of the Guy Fieri restaurant in Times Square.
That was a classic. That review.
So he starts out just by pretending that he's having an honest conversation with Guy Fieri. He says, Guy Fieri, have you eaten at your new restaurant in Times Square? Have you pulled up one of the 500 guest seats at Guy's American Kitchen and Bar and ordered a meal? Did you eat the food? And then it's a series of questions after that, like, did panic grip your soul as you stared into the whirling hypno wheel of the menu, where adjectives and nouns spin in a crazy vortex? And it goes on and on. And near the end, one of my favorite ones was it's a series of questions. Why did the toasted marshmallow taste like fish? But he's found a way to do it. His editors love it. The readers love it. It's a little bit of a comic genius thing that he's doing.
There's a little bit of class snobbery in it, too. He didn't go to Masa and say, how come your sushi isn't that much better than other people? And we're now supposed to genuflect before you're sourcing. Because rich people go to that and it insults. Whereas Guy Fieri, it's a funny piece, but Guy Fieri is the safe target. Mm-hmm. I could name chefs in New York he wouldn't do that to.
That's true. He is a safe target, but his food probably does suck.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah, and so there is a real aesthetic judgment going on, you know.
But he's shooting an ant with an elephant gun.
Yes.
Actually.
I mean, I guess that's the interesting thing, is it's hard to know which ones are big. See, Guy Fieri is such a big one that it does seem fair. He's got a media empire pushing him. You know, in the same way that I always felt it was fair to clobber as ruthlessly as you wanted to any studio movie, when you realize that you might have to beg to see the movie because they wanted to control all of the discourse on the film with $30 million in advertising, you know, once you're there, you then don't think, I have to feel sympathetic for them. If I was a food critic or a theater critic or something where you can actually end somebody's business overnight, you know, that would probably change me.
What do you ask yourself before you write a pan? For example, if you were a book critic, I would ask you, would you ever pan a first novel?
I would pan a first novel, but probably I wouldn't pan a first novel unless it had been receiving all sorts of praise.
Right, and that's the decision we make all the time.
It is, yeah. I guess what I would say, and this is probably a change in how I've done business over the years, I would have thought when I was younger that I should be as ruthlessly honest as I should be, and ideally hilarious, okay? You know, that, you know, mean is good almost because we're so filled with mediocrity. Along the way, I began thinking that probably there should be some love in what you're doing, and that when you are being nasty about something, often you weren't doing it for their own good, say. Mm-hmm. You weren't doing it for the good of the readers. You were doing it to prove how smart you are or to win a cheap laugh, which is one of the reasons why it's harder to pan a first novel. You know, because also think, like, there's so many novels, and at least the places I work are kind of elite spots. I mean, people want to be in Vogue and they want to be on Fresh Air. So with so much stuff out there, to choose something that's small and clobberate seems insane.
Yeah.
Because there's also some first novel by somebody who's good that is probably going to sink without a trace unless you say something about it.
That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank John Powers, our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our interns, Eric Webster and Ernesto Aureliano, and the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. Our apologies to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but BJ, we promise to have you on next week. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, I am Seth Greenland, and you have been listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. See you next week. Bring a towel.